Okay, good morning everybody. This is Bio 231, March 11th. And, there's an open lab Friday that I know about. Dr. Sanchez is going to be there from 10 until 1. 10 until 1 on Friday. So that's probably pretty good news. Because you might have, do you have another practicum next week?
Yeah,
most of you guys? Okay. On muscles, here's the sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, please. All right, so does anybody have any questions? No questions? That's good. Yes. Yeah, I'm going to show you where this is. Okay, this is one of the exam figures, and it's kind of hidden in Blackboard, unfortunately. It took me a little while to find it. Oh, a couple of things were hidden in Blackboard. Somebody had a question. Somebody emailed me about pre-lecture assignment 11, I believe it was, or 12, or one of those assignments. And it really was on Blackboard, but it was out of order. It was about five assignments down. So I switched it to go in the right position. The answer key is there. Okay, so maybe you found that before I did. But anyway, homework assignment is back in the right spot for you to work on. And, well, I tell you what, since I'm here, let me talk about where you can find these figures. All right, so let's go to Blackboard and let's find an anatomy class. I had some animations I wanted to show you today. They play, but it doesn't show up on the screen, so I'm going to have to spend a little time to try to figure out how to show you those at a later time. That's this semester? Yeah, I think that's good. Okay, so let's see. Your study guides under course documents. Course documents? Yes, here we go. Lecture slides? No. Study guides. And you're interested in maybe exam number 3? Yeah, okay. Number 3. So here is 3 with figures and without figures, but way down over here, you see what? Exam 3, and this has 2 additional figures for you. All right, so I just appended it to the list. That has to show you the figures I'm going to show you today, which cover the motor unit and the neuromuscular junction. Okay, so you can open those. You can find it right there. So it's right at the bottom. I probably, if I have time, maybe I'll move it up and put it right underneath right here. So you might have to look for it, but it's going to be in there. Okay, so let's look at this figure right here. What we see is, for instance, what's this? Bone, okay. What kind of tissue is that? Connective tissue. And what is this? A tendon, right? So a muscle-to-bone connection is a tendon. What kind of tissue is that? Dense, regular connective tissue. And then we have the muscle itself, right? So this is just a really quick review. And the cross-section of the muscle, you see that the muscles are arranged in different bundles. What do we call those bundles? Fascicles. And inside a fascicle, the building block of a fascicle is muscle fiber. And here you can see a number of muscle fibers, and you can see that they are nicely striated, right? So what causes that striated appearance of skeletal muscle? That's the sarcomeres are arranged right after each other, and what makes the sarcomere show up are the different bands, the A bands and the I bands, and the dark band, of course, is the... is a dark band? What protein is making up the dark band?
Myosin.
It's the thick one, so it blocks a lot of light. Actin is the thin one and lets light penetrate it, so it looks lighter. That would be making the I band. All right, but on this slide right here, we see how muscle fibers are controlled. All right, so when you use, let's just say, maybe this is the brachialis muscle, for instance. Brachialis goes where? From the humerus down to the ulna. And when it contracts, it's going to cause forearm flexion. Now, how can you contract that brachialis? Is it an all or none response, or do you have graded response? Or can you even flex halfway and stop, for instance? You have really nice control over that muscle, right? And all the muscle, all the skeletal muscles in your body. All right, so how do those skeletal muscles get a command to contract? It comes from your brain, okay, and it leaves your central nervous system via these nerve fibers right here. All right, and somebody had a good idea. So what was your idea? Oh, okay, we're going to get to a little bit of a molecular level in just a second. Okay, but I'm just talking about how skeletal muscle is being controlled. And we haven't gotten to the nervous system yet, but there's a part of your brain, in the front part of your brain, frontal lobe, all right, that you initiate motor signals with. And they eventually find their way down to the spinal cord and leave the spinal cord. And so the nerves that go to skeletal muscle, because skeletal muscles are making something move in your body, right? What kind of object or what kind of device do you use every day to move things around? Yeah, your hands, but not part of your body. It's some other part of your life, but not your body. What kind of device do you use to move something around? What is it? It's a, what do you use to move your car around?
Motor.
Yeah, a motor. Okay, so you could have, like, if you want to move air around, you have an electric motor with a fan blade, and that moves things around. So something that moves something around is a motor. All right, so here are nerve fibers that send signals down to these skeletal muscle cells, which basically are, well, we call those effectors, but they're basically motors because they move things around for you. They move parts of your body. Oh yeah, we'll talk about that when we get into nervous system. It's a fascinating chapter, but we're almost done with muscles, and then we might start nervous system today in just a little bit. Okay, but so here's the first part of your nervous system lecture that you're going to get, and that is, since these nerves are taking signals from the spinal cord, right, to these muscle fibers, we call these motor neurons. Those neurons don't move. They're just carrying signals to tell the muscle fibers to contract or not. Okay. So how many motor neurons do you see on this slide?
Two.
Yeah, you got two motor neurons. And notice that they bifurcate. They split up. Here's a bifurcation. So this is motor neuron number two. How many muscle cells does motor neuron number two go to?
Three.
You can see it split up into three, right? So when there is a signal coming down motor neuron number two, it goes to this muscle fiber, and this muscle fiber, causing it to contract. And a muscle fiber always contracts. It can never make up its mind if it's going to contract or not, right? Because what part of, well, we don't know that yet in here. It's part of your, you know, something about skeletal muscle and cardiac and smooth muscle. What's one big difference between skeletal that separates it from smooth and cardiac muscle? It's voluntary muscle, right. So when these signals come down from your brain to these motor neurons and stimulate these skeletal muscle cells, they contract all the time. They can't make up their mind if they're going to contract or not. They just do it to the best of their ability, right? And that's what you want. For instance, if you want to, like during a test, pick up an eraser and erase something on your Scantron, and you send those signals down to those muscles to do that, you don't want those muscles to say, no, I don't want to do that, right? Skeletal muscles always obey your commands. All right, so the signals come down from motor neuron number two, and only these three fibers contract to the best of their ability, but these two right here don't contract, right, if there's no signal coming down from them. So there is something called a motor unit, and a motor unit is described or defined as one motor neuron and all of the muscle fibers that it innervates. Those are the muscle fibers that it controls. That's the motor unit. So we see how many motor units on this slide right here? There are actually two. But in real life, you have what? You have thousands. and the number of muscle fibers that you have that are controlled by one motor neuron varies in different parts of your body, depending on the job those different muscles are doing for you. All right, so for instance, if there's a part of your body where you need to have fine, discriminative control, where you need to have a lot of dexterity, like where would be a part of your body that you need to have very fine motor control for very fine kinds of motions and movements? Okay, like for your fingers, maybe for your lips for articulation, right, for speaking and breathing, you need to have very good control. So in that particular case, right, you have a motor unit that is relatively small. So you may have a motor neuron innervating maybe two or three fibers. So it contracts very gently, right? But you have many of them going to all of the muscle fibers in that part of the body, right? As opposed to the number of motor units that you have going to postural muscles in your back. So what kinds of interesting things can you do with your back muscles? Can you like play a violin or a flute or write, talk or anything like that? So not really, right? So postural muscles pretty much only contract or relax. That's all that they do. You don't really manipulate anything with your back muscles. So you do not need fine discriminative control. So you don't have many motor units going to your back. So in that particular case, one motor neuron might innervate maybe as many as 1,000 muscle fibers, causing them to contract, because you don't need to have that same level of control of those muscle fibers. Okay. All right. The other thing that motor units that you should have an appreciation for is that there are times, for instance, when you're going to pick up something that's really light, like a pencil or an eraser, and then there are other times, maybe there's something that's going to be really heavy that you have to lift up. So how is your body going to adjust itself to pick up something of a big difference in weight? Like what would be really heavy that you have to move? A pencil would be really light, but what would be really heavy? Yeah, like for a TV. Yeah, you want to move your TV around from one place to another, you need a lot more muscles contracting. All right. So if you're going to pick up a pencil, for instance, you might only have motor unit number one here contracting, which is going to produce, what, a very weak kind of contraction. But motor unit number two is not going to contract at all, so just motor unit number one. But now if you're going to lift something heavy, right, you're going to use motor unit number one plus motor unit number two, maybe some other motor units as well. Maybe all of the muscles are going to contract. Right? And when your body adds motor units to increase the tension or force of contraction that a muscle can generate, we call that recruitment. So motor units can be recruited to lift heavier and heavier and heavier weights. So those are some things about a motor unit that you should be aware of. Okay, and that is that first off, a muscle fiber will either contract or relax, and when it's told to contract, it will contract to its best ability. But the reason why a whole muscle, maybe like the brachialis right here, can perform graded contractions or weak contractions or really strong contractions is because the brachialis can recruit, right, more motor units to contract. That means more skeletal muscle fibers are going to contract. So this is a pretty important concept. All right, so how does a skeletal muscle receive information to contract? And you can see a connection between the motor neuron and the muscle fiber right here. This is a very interesting junction. And that junction right there falls into the following category. And we're going to discuss how cells communicate with each other, neighboring cells. And they communicate with each other through something called a synapse. All right, so a synapse is a synapse is a structural and functional unit of communication between cells. So this is how neighboring cells communicate with each other, how a nerve cell can communicate with a muscle cell, and how one nerve cell can communicate with another nerve cell, or maybe how even neighboring myocardial cells communicate with each other. And there are two kinds of synapses. One is a chemical synapse, and a second kind is an electrical kind of synapse. All right, and so what we're going to look at right now is a chemical kind of synapse. And in skeletal muscle, one kind that we're going to look at is the neuromuscular junction. So if somebody says neuromuscular junction, where should you be thinking? It's the connection between a motor neuron and a muscle. Yeah, a motor neuron and a muscle. And these neuromuscular junctions are typically very, very large. You can see that there are a lot of bifurcations right here, and it extends over a lot of the muscle cell. That's the neuromuscular junction. So let's see if we can find what the neuromuscular junction looks like. So let's zoom in a little bit. So here is a motor neuron, and you can see the bifurcations. And at the swelling of every motor neuron, at the tip of every motor neuron, there is a swelling. And there are special things in the tips of these axons. So we call this the axon terminal. It maybe goes by other names. Sometimes we call it a terminal button because it looks like a button. Sometimes it's called a bouton terminale. What's a bouton terminale? That's a terminal button. Yeah. Okay. So it goes by a number of different names. Or sometimes people even call them terminal boutons. Okay. So people mix and match words all the time. But this basically right here is a synapse. This is how a motor neuron communicates with a muscle cell in particular. All right, so now let's zoom into this region right here. So we can see the axon terminal right here. This is the tip of an axon or a nerve fiber. And it's going to associate with the muscle. So how do you know this is the muscle down over here? Because what can you see? Yeah, it's got a sarcomere in there, and you can see the myosin, right, and the actin. You can see the Z discs real easy. What band is this right here? Okay. What band? What band is this? This is the I band, and this is the A band. Okay, H band is right smack in the middle, so H would be, I was a little sloppy when I was drawing. Here's the H band, right, and then the A band is the whole length of this myosin right here. Okay, so I see the tip of a neuron, and there's a space between the muscle cell and the tip of the neuron. Now I'm just going to call this the terminal bouton, or the bouton right here, little button. And since this is a synapse, the space between the cells is called a synaptic cleft. That's a space. Yeah?
So if the neuron and the muscle have those kind of space, how are they held together?
Oh, yeah, that's very important. I'll talk about some of that stuff. Okay? All right, so the way that information is passed down a neuron, okay, down this motor neuron here, is as an electrical signal. That's an electrical signal, and when we get to the next chapter, we'll talk about a little bit of the basis of that electrical signal. All right, and it gets down to the terminal button right here, and that electrical signal stops. All right, so I guess I'll just stay on this picture right now. It stops because the electrical signal can't go across this space right here. Electrical signals can't hop from one cell to another cell, but if it did, it would be like a lightning bolt. And our cells don't have lightning bolts going between them. All right, so that information has to be carried some other way. It can't be carried as an electrical signal. So what has evolved is that signal, the electrical signal, when it comes down a nerve, it gets converted into a chemical signal. And that chemical is released from the terminal button, and it moves across the synaptic cleft. That space is called the synaptic cleft. And that signal then can bind to the muscle cell, causing the muscle cell to develop an electrical signal. So the way information is transmitted from the neuron into the muscle is first it's an electrical signal, It gets converted into a chemical signal, and then what happens? It gets converted back into an electrical signal once again. So through this kind of synapse, the signal is electrical, chemical, electrical. All right, and that electricity is going to cause, the electrical signal will cause the muscle to contract. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Well, because the electricity can't go right across that space. All right, the cells would have to touch each other for electricity to go from one cell to the other cell. All right, if electricity was going to go from one cell across the space into the other one, it would have to be a lightning bolt, right? It would have to be a flash of electricity. And that just doesn't happen. All right, now there are some cells where electricity can go from one cell into the neighboring cell, and that's not a chemical synapse, that would be an electrical synapse. And I think I'm going to talk about that sometime during the class, but not today. Okay? Those cells actually have to touch each other for that to happen. All right, so let's look in a little bit more detail. All of this activity right here requires a lot of energy. What's an energy molecule? ATP, that's right. These cells need to have ATP. What's the organelle that makes ATP for the cells? Mitochondria. Do you see any mitochondria here? Absolutely. So the terminal button has to have a lot of mitochondria because that area needs a lot of ATP. A lot of ATP to synthesize the chemical that's going to be secreted from the terminal button. All right, so when a nerve cell releases a signaling molecule into the synaptic cleft, we call that molecule something. We're real close. It's called a neurotransmitter. So when a neuron releases a signaling molecule, that signaling molecule is called neurotransmitter, and there are a number of important neurotransmitters in your body. At the neuromuscular junction, the name of that neurotransmitter is always 100% acetylcholine. So acetylcholine is a specific name for a neurotransmitter that's released at the neuromuscular junction. And the neuromuscular junction is a synapse, right? It's just a structural and functional unit of communication between two cells. So what kind of synapse is it? It is a chemical synapse, right? Okay. All right. So what does a synapse have? Well, a chemical synapse has got this swelling for mitochondria, and there also are vesicles filled with neurotransmitter. All right. So it's got to be an enlarged area of the tip of the axon. A synapse, a chemical synapse, also has this synaptic cleft right here filled with fluid. All right. And then another structural part of a synapse is that the cell that's going to receive the signal has got to have receptors in it so that the neurotransmitter can bind to that receptor and cause another electrical signal to develop. So those are all the parts of a synapse. So this is sometimes what we call the presynaptic membrane. And guess what we call this membrane right here? That's the postsynaptic membrane, pre and post. And so signaling molecules always go from the presynaptic cell to the postsynaptic cell. Okay? Anybody have any questions so far?
Is the neuron,
the membrane of the neuron, right where I have the cursor right now.
Okay.
Yeah? And the postsynaptic membrane is right here. It's on the muscle cell in the neuromuscular junction. Okay? So one membrane can release neurotransmitter, which is the presynaptic membrane. The other one can receive that information, and that is the postsynaptic membrane. But there has to be a special component of the postsynaptic membrane in order for the muscle to be sensitive to acetylcholine. What does the postsynaptic cell have to have in order to be able to listen for acetylcholine? It's got to have a receptor molecule or a receptor protein in the membrane for acetylcholine. And when acetylcholine binds to it, that causes another electrical signal in the muscle cell right here. Okay. So you might ask, well, how is it that electricity, when it's coming down the axon, how can that cause the fusion of this vesicle right here that has neurotransmitter in it to the presynaptic membrane? Well, there's a signal, there's a chemical signal, and that is this calcium is important. All right, so when an electrical signal comes down the axon, that opens up channels that allow calcium to enter the terminal button right here, and when that calcium comes in, it causes the fusion of the synaptic vesicle to the membrane and release of neurotransmitter. So in order for information to go across the neuromuscular junction, what ion is really important?
Calcium
ion is very, very important. That's right. So what's another place did you learn that calcium ion plays a very important role in physiology? Yeah? Okay, muscle contraction I like. In order for what? The myosin and actin filaments to slide over each other, calcium ions are necessary for that. All right? And we have for communication across the synapse, calcium is important. Right, sliding of the actin and myosin filaments, and the third place so far calcium is important is in bones, right? All right, so now, what do you think would be most important to have good calcium levels so that cells can communicate with each other, like at the neuromuscular junction, or for actin and myosin to be able to slide over each other, or to have strong bones?
All of the above.
But you can't have all the above. Let's just say you can only have two. What would you choose? Muscle contraction, and also so that cells can communicate with each other. And this is what we call synaptic transmission. So neurons can't even communicate with each other. You would have no perception of your reality unless there's a proper level of calcium outside the cell. So again, calcium levels in bones are what a kind of the last thought of last area of importance in your body to have proper calcium, right? And your body knows that too. So as we get older, that's one of the reasons why bone is sacrificed to maintain proper calcium levels in our body for synaptic transmission and muscle contraction. Those are just two so far that we're talking about. Okay. Now, when that electrical signal develops on this membrane right here, the postsynaptic membrane, where does it go? It goes over the cell membrane. What do we call the cell membrane of a muscle cell? The sarcolemma, yeah, that's the sarcolemma. And then, so it flows over the whole muscle cell. But where else does it go? It goes down this T-tubule, right? Can you remember that? The electrical signal goes down the T-tubule, and then it stimulates an organelle to release even more calcium around the actin and myosin filaments right here. What's the organelle that releases calcium into the myofibril? That's the... Yeah, we changed the name a little bit. It's called the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So the sarcoplasmic reticulum releases calcium into the sarcomere, and then that causes the cross bridges to form, and the myosin pulls on the actin, and they slide over each other, causing the Z-discs to come closer together, causing the sarcomere to shorten. Okay, so that's another important reason for calcium in muscle cells. All right, so I do want you to know something about the neuromuscular junction. And what is a neuromuscular junction? A general term for neuromuscular junction. It's a synapse, right? And when you think and what kind of synapse is it? It's a chemical synapse. And what are two membranes involved with a chemical synapse? Yeah, the presynaptic and the postsynaptic membrane. All right, so how does a signal move across a synapse, a chemical synapse? How does it move across? As a chemical signal. What's the general name of a chemical signal that's used to move across a synapse? Yeah, neurotransmitter. And at the neuromuscular junction, what's the name of the neurotransmitter? Acetylcholine is the name of the neurotransmitter. All right, so how is it that signal, why is it that signals can't go backwards across the synapse? How come the muscle can't tell the neuron something? Because the synapse is a one-way street. Exactly right. Why is that? Because only the neuron has the neurotransmitter, and only the muscle has the receptor, right? So only one can send a signal, and the other one is the only one that can receive the signal. So signals can only go in one direction, from the neuron into the muscle because of that. Okay. All right, now you have some questions, right? When this muscle is stimulated, what is that muscle going to do? I like that. You actually moved. Yeah, it's going to contract, okay? All right, so the only difference really between a chemical synapse at the neuromuscular junction compared to a synapse between two neurons is that when two neurons communicate with each other, they don't contract at all. They stay in one fixed position. But when this muscle cell is stimulated, it's going to contract, it's going to move. So the neuromuscular junction has specific proteins that help attach the axon terminus to the muscle cell so that it doesn't move around. Right? So that's really the only difference between this kind of synapse and one between two nerve cells. Because if the synaptic button moved over to this location or over here on a muscle cell, it would lose the ability to communicate to it. And I would ask you why. The axon still would release neurotransmitter on this region right here, but why would communication be lost? Because there are no receptors in this area to pick up that signal. The receptors are where? Way over here. Yeah, way over here. Okay? So that's really the only difference. You had a question about that. Why? How come things don't move around? And that's because they're attached to each other with specific proteins. Okay? All right, so we don't have to know those things. This area right here that has the receptors for acetylcholine, we call that the motor end plate. So the motor end plate also has adhesion molecules to make sure that it never loses track of the axon terminus. Yeah. Okay. And that is, for instance, if it was just flat, let's just say, if we have the postsynaptic membrane, and every maybe 1 centimeter, we were able to put a receptor molecule. So on this length right here, how many receptor molecules could a cell put in? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. All right, but let's keep the distance the same. But let's just say we want a lot more receiving molecules here to increase the sensitivity so that that part of the cell would be very sensitive and listen intently for that acetylcholine signal. So what happens in all places in your body where you need a large surface area to stick into a small space, how would you do that? So maybe you need twice as many receptor molecules. How would you fit this thing into this space right here? You bend it up. You convolute it. So now what? You have all these receptor molecules, but it's in what? A smaller space. So that's why that membrane is all bent up like that. Okay. So we're going to see that as a very important motif in the brain, for instance, and in the kidney. I had another one on the tip of my tongue, but I forgot. Okay. So that's why it's all bent like that. Just to increase the sensitivity of transmission across the membrane. And that's because every time neurotransmitter is released, that always causes a significant change, electrical change in this membrane right here, so that muscles will always contract. Okay, this muscle right here can never make up its mind if it's going to contract if it gets a signal from this neuron. And that's because this is what? A voluntary muscle that's under your voluntary control. Okay, anybody have a question on motor unit, for instance, or the neuromuscular junction? No? Okay. All right, well, I think we have one more chapter to cover for the next test, which is not next week, but it might be the week after. All right, so I think I'm going to move on to that, and maybe the nervous system students typically find the most challenging of the whole class. I'm not so sure why that is. So we'll get a nice start with that, and spend a lot of time with the nervous system. Yeah.
Your PowerPoint has connected non-depolarization.
Okay. Depolarization. I'm going to talk about depolarization in the nervous system chapter. Yeah. Yeah, we get to talk about that a little bit. Okay. All right, I tell you what, let me take a quick look and see, did I miss anything else on this list right here? No, troponin. I think that goes beyond this class. Yeah, we don't have troponin and tropomyosin in the textbook. Okay. All right, so let's start to learn something about nervous system. Not sure that's the right slide. So what do we have for nervous system? How come it's not here? Who took it? Here we go. Mislabeled. Okay. Ah, I like this. Good. All right, so chapter 12. That looks good. All right, so here is an illustration of the nervous system if we were to look at somebody's whole body. And you can see that it's kind of almost broken down, like the skeleton is broken down into. What are the two main components of the skeletal system? And when you talk, I'm not thinking bones and ligaments and tendons, but what are the two main areas of the skeletal system? You've got, for the skeletal system, you've got the axial skeleton and the appendicular skeleton, right? So in terms of the nervous system, think along those lines. There are two major parts to the nervous system. There's something called the central nervous system. You've probably all heard of that term, right? And when you think of central nervous system, what do you think of? You think of brain. Oh, thanks so much. You think of brain. And that's definitely true. The brain is part of the central nervous system, but that's not the only part. The other part is the spinal cord right here. Yeah, so brain and spinal cord is the central nervous system, and everything else is what we call the peripheral nervous system. So that's maybe one thing that you didn't hear about before taking this class, but central just means what? Centrally located, brain and spinal cord. Peripheral is everything else in the periphery of your body. So a really good thing to look at maybe throughout the next couple chapters is this diagram right here. Okay? Nervous system divisions. So if you're going to think of the nervous system as one unit and break it into two parts, what are the two main parts? Central nervous system versus peripheral nervous system. Central is brain and spinal cord, and peripheral nervous system is everything else. But we're going to now dissect the peripheral nervous system down into a couple divisions as well. All right, so we're going to have to add some other things in here. So don't be shy about marking this thing up. I just didn't want to mark it all up at one time. The peripheral nervous system can be broken down into two parts. And they're going to have functional consequences, but what can you tell me about if something has two different kinds of functions, what might you think? It has two different kinds of structures associated with it as well, right? So there's always relationships between structure and function. So for instance, the peripheral nervous system, one division, major division, based by function, is what we call the afferent division. Or you could say afferent, right? But I will say afferent so that you don't get it confused with another term. All right, and afferent just means sensory, right? That's a sensory division. That's a functional classification. So that means signals are moving in what direction between the peripheral nervous system and the central nervous system? Yeah, so what does your environment have access to? Your peripheral nervous system or central nervous system? Your peripheral, right? Your the rest of your body. So your peripheral nervous system picks up information from the environment and sends it to the central nervous system, right? So that's the sensory division. Another name for sensory is afferent, right? So sensory organs to central nervous system. And that's the way information flows. Okay. The other division is what we call motor, or efferent division. Efferent versus afferent. All right, so a motor division is when signals originate in the central nervous system and move to the periphery, out to your body. All right, so do y'all see the difference between afferent versus efferent? Yeah, okay. All right, furthermore, the motor division or the efferent division can be broken down into a couple different kinds as well. And you're probably familiar with this already. One nervous system is called the somatic nervous system. And somatic just means that it's going to go to skeletal muscle. How do you control skeletal muscle? With your conscious thought, right? That's under voluntary control. So somatic really means what? Voluntary control in this particular context. All right, but don't forget, this is still motor. But what kinds of things don't you have to control in your body? Are there things that you don't control that take care of themselves? Yeah, like your heart, your lungs, for instance, the way your eyes dilate or constrict depending on light. All right, many, many things. Your blood pressure you can't control with your mind. Probably a lot of people wish they could, but right, it kind of takes care of itself. Sometimes it does a good job, sometimes not. What's the pathology associated with blood pressure? Yeah, when your blood pressure is too high, all right, we call that hypertension. And that's very common, right? Probably in the whole world, but for sure in the United States. So the autonomic nervous system controls all of those things, your heart rate, your blood pressure, glands when they secrete something. Okay. So in this particular case, then, the things that these muscles control are what we call effectors. All right, so an effector in the somatic nervous system is going to be skeletal muscle, and effectors in the autonomic nervous system are going to be three things. That's pretty simple. Only three things in the autonomic nervous system: effectors in the autonomic nervous system are cardiac muscle. What else? Smooth muscle. And glands. That might be on your sheet someplace. If it's not, make sure you jot that down. Okay, those are the effectors in the autonomic nervous system. Okay, so as a matter of fact, what is the only thing that you can control with your mind? Skeletal muscle. That's the only thing you have control of. Everything else gets taken care of for you by the autonomic nervous system. Okay, furthermore, the autonomic nervous system can be broken down into two divisions as well. All right, and now this relates to probably the most important, oh, there it is. Didn't have to write it on the board. All right. This relates to what I consider the most important thing to learn in an anatomy or physiology class. All right, and we have two nervous systems within the autonomic nervous system, and they are the sympathetic, and the second one is the parasympathetic nervous system. All right, and what was the most important concept that I wanted you to know when taking this class? The concept of antagonism. Being what? Antagonism is good or bad?
Good.
Fantastic, right? All right, because your whole body, the way it's controlled, how homeostasis is maintained, is through antagonistic mechanisms. All right, so here we see the sympathetic and parasympathetic, and you could guess what's the relationship between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. They're going to be antagonistic to each other. Right, so if one has a stimulatory effect, the other is going to have an inhibitory effect on various organs in your body. Like, for instance, what kinds of things? Smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. Right? Okay. So some of these things are a chapter all by themselves, so I can't get into a lot of detail. So maybe one of the last things that we're going to look at in nervous system is the autonomic nervous system. All right, and this is not voluntary, These organs are deep inside your body, so sometimes we call these visceral organs, as opposed to skeletal muscles. Skeletal muscles aren't visceral organs. They are what we call somatic organs, right? They're more on the surface of your body. They're not deep inside a cavity. All right, so always refer to this diagram right here during the class and layer some important details in there as we go. All right, so the nervous system is the master control and communication center of the body. Its chief functional divisions are sensory. All right, so that takes what? Information from the periphery, from your body into your central nervous system. All right, and then there's motor output, the efferent neurons that take information from your central nervous system to your periphery, to effectors to have you interact with your environment. But we didn't mention stuff that's in between. And that's what we call the integration center or association areas. And those are all the neurons that are inside your brain and central nervous system that don't enter or leave. They're just in there by themselves altogether, keeping track of everything. Right? Those are the association areas. All right, so the basic structural divisions, yeah, we covered that already. Mostly. Okay? I didn't cover these things. But I'll go back and talk about them after we learn something more about the nervous system. Okay, I talked about that already. Okay, nervous tissue. All right, well, we studied tissues already in this class. So what are the four basic kinds of tissues again? You got connective tissue, muscle tissue, nervous tissue, and epithelium, right? Those are the four. Epithelium, connective, muscle, and nervous tissue. So now we're going to look at some nervous tissue. What were the two kinds of cells that make up nervous tissue? Okay, close, but remember, connective tissue had a number of different divisions. You had what? Bone and blood and adipose. And nervous tissue only had two. Neurons was one. And, oh, maybe you don't know how to pronounce the second one. That's why you're not telling me. It's what? Neuroglia, or neuroglial cells, right? So nervous tissue is made up of neurons, or neuroglia, all right? And one transmits electrical impulses, and the other one doesn't. Which one of those two transmits electrical impulses? Yeah, the neurons, and the neuroglia are support cells, all right? So just to have in the back of your mind those two different kinds of cells. So what we're going to look at first, all right, is a neuron. All right, so a neuron is the kind that can receive information and transmit electrical signals very fast over long distances in your body. And the signal lasts for only a very short period of time. All right, so let's see if we can find the structure of a neuron someplace. All right, so here's a good neuron to look at. All right, so this yellow or gold guy right here is a neuron. These things that kind of look like squished pearls, those are actually neuroglia cells. So I just want you to concentrate on the gold color first. And this kind of, so here's a neuron, and what can you tell me about this neuron? Is it like a squamous cell, or is it columnar? Or what can you tell me about the shape of this neuron? It looks, you know what? It doesn't really obey what? It doesn't look squamous, doesn't look columnar, it doesn't look cuboidal. It looks like what? It looks wild with all these things sticking out of it. All right, so these are what we call processes. So these kinds of cells have processes, they have things poking out of it. And some of them have these short and many branches on them. These are what we call dendrites. And then also, there's one other major process that is what? Really, really long. And in this particular cell, there's only one. And this is what we call an axon. And an axon might actually be 1,000, maybe even 10,000 times longer than a dendrite. But an axon doesn't have a lot of branches on it. It's just a single process coming out until you get down to the axon terminus. And then you have the branching pattern, and then what do you have at the end of every axon terminus? You have a terminal button, right? Filled with synaptic vesicles, filled with neurotransmitter, okay? All right, so this kind of cell is specialized to transmit electrical impulses, and guess what? The direction is one way, just like the transmission of a signal across the synapse over here is a one-way street. The way an electrical impulse is transmitted is a one-way street as well. And how does it go? How does an electrical signal move down an axon? From a dendrite to a cell body and then down an axon. That's the only way an electrical signal can go. Yeah.
How do the neurons communicate with each other?
Yeah, through synapses. Just like, think of the neuromuscular junction. What kind of synapse is a neuromuscular junction? It's a chemical synapse. And the way neurons communicate with each other is through a chemical synapse as well. Okay? And so if you know what the neuromuscular junction kind of looks like, there's a presynaptic cell, postsynaptic cell, synaptic vesicles. Which cell has synaptic vesicles? The presynaptic cell. So the same structure, okay, exists for the communication between neurons as well. This is way, right. They only can communicate one way. But that's okay because, why is that okay? Because we have different divisions in, for instance, the peripheral nervous system. What are the two divisions? Afferent versus efferent. So in order for signals to enter your brain, that needs a whole set of neurons. For signals to leave your brain, that needs a whole other set of neurons. So you can't use one neuron to be both motor and sensory at the same time. It won't work. It can only be one way. All right? And that's because the synapse only works one way, but electrical impulses can only go in one direction as well. So you need two neurons to share that information properly. All right, so you see the different processes. These short branched ones are dendrites. This long one right here is an axon. And in the middle, that's the cell body of a neuron. And another name for a cell body is a soma. And inside the soma, you have the nucleus that's controlling the activity of the cell. You have a lot of endoplasmic reticulum that's making, for instance, what does a neuron have to make that other cells don't have to make a lot of? The signaling molecule. What's the signaling molecule? A neurotransmitter, right? So the neuron has to be busy making neurotransmitter. And so the extensive rough endoplasmic reticulum stains very darkly. We call that Nissl substance or Nissl bodies, right? So we find that in the cell body as well, along with, you think a neuron needs a lot of energy? Yeah, a lot of energy. So guess what is also found in the cell body? A lot of mitochondria. Yeah, a lot of ATP, and what makes ATP are mitochondria. So you have a lot of mitochondria in the cell body as well. You know, not so much in the cell body. Okay, where is calcium important? In the axon terminus. All right, there are other ions that are necessary. We'll talk about two other ions. All right, so calcium is important for synaptic transmission, so along these dendrites right here and the axon terminus. All right, so what else can I tell you about this neuron? This one right here is what we call a multipolar neuron. Okay, because the cell has polarity. When we say something has polarity, what does that mean? What does that mean when we say something has polarity? That means when you look at something, it's got at least two ends to it. Can you tell the difference between the ends of this marker right here? If you couldn't tell the ends of this marker, if you had a teacher who couldn't tell the ends of this marker, what would they do? They would write on the board like that, okay, and nothing would happen. Because this marker is polar. One end has a little felt with ink coming out of it, and the other end has nothing coming out of it, right? So this marker right here is polar. All right, so this cell is polar, multipolar, because on one end, what does it have? All these different dendrites, and on the other end, it has this long axon. All right, so we call that a multipolar neuron. Okay. Okay, the other thing that I see what we're going to talk about in a little bit are these cells right here. They're called Schwann cells. and they help regulate how fast an impulse moves down an axon. All right, but I think we're going to leave that to maybe a little bit later on in this chapter. Fast. When the Schwann cell is here, it makes the impulse fast. If this was just a naked axon right here, the impulse would be slow. Right? Maybe 100 times slower. Okay, let's see what else on this one right here. So, which end of this neuron can release neurotransmitter? Only the axon terminals. All right? And what end of this neuron has receptors for receiving signals? Yeah, the dendrites. Okay. The other part of the cell that has receptor proteins is also the cell body. So the dendrites and cell body have receptor proteins. So this part of the cell can receive signals, and this part of the cell can send signals as a result of that. Okay, so this particular neuron right here is typically what we find for either an interneuron or a motor neuron. Okay, so maybe jot that down. Motor. What's the function of a motor neuron? Yeah, it takes signals out of the central nervous system to the periphery. Or sometimes we will find this kind of shape of a cell as an association neuron. And association neurons are found completely within the central nervous system. They're never, no part of them is ever found in the peripheral nervous system. All right, I'll mention that one again a couple of times. But this is a good teaching slide of what a general neuron looks like. Okay, so here is an actual picture of a multipolar neuron. Here is the, what is this area right here? Oops, this area right here is the cell body. And then these small projections are dendrites. And then the axon, I don't know, can you see something scooting down someplace? Not very well. That's why we like illustrations. Okay. But I see a lot of other cells that are surrounding this cell right here. At least I can see the nuclei of them. And what surrounds our planet?
Water.
Water, yeah. Okay, there's a lot of, yeah. But like out in space, there are, well, there's a satellite. We have one satellite. What's the satellite around the planet? That's the moon. Some planets have what? A lot of satellites. All right, so these cells right here sometimes are called satellite cells because they kind of surround the main motor neuron. I'll talk about that when we get to neuroglia, but we're not done talking about neurons yet. But I'm glad you're taking this class. You seem to have a lot of interest in this class, a lot of good questions. Okay. All right, so here we see, all right, we see two neurons. And what did we say? What's the shape of these neurons right here? These are multipolar neurons. Okay. And so here's the, now how did we say these neurons communicate with each other? What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells?
Synapse.
That's a synapse. And between two neurons, it's a chemical synapse, just like the neuromuscular junction. All right, so we can move away from this kind of complicated diagram to look at this one right here. So what does this represent?
Cell body.
This represents the axon. Don't forget, signals can only go in this particular direction. And then we have the axon terminus. What do we call this space between the cells? Synaptic cleft, right? All right, so this is a synapse, and in particular a chemical synapse. So what neuron is this in this unit that we're looking at? This is the presynaptic neuron. This is the postsynaptic neuron. So what is the presynaptic neuron going to do when an electrical signal comes down the axon? It's going to release something, a neurotransmitter, all right? And sometimes that might be acetylcholine. Does anybody else have any favorite neurotransmitters that they like? It's maybe okay if you don't know. Epinephrine. I tell you what, norepinephrine would be one. Maybe you've heard of things like serotonin. Maybe you've heard of things like dopamine. These are all different kinds of neurotransmitters that are used across the synapse right here. Okay? All right, so this is just a synapse. And don't forget, information always flows in one direction. Why can't information go backwards from the postsynaptic cell to the presynaptic cell? Because the dendrites of the postsynaptic cell don't have a neurotransmitter, right? Can't go backwards. And the axon terminals here don't have receptor, so the signal can't go backwards. Okay. All right, so here we have a number of different kinds of synapses. This is how neurons communicate with each other. So here we can see an axon coming down from this red neuron. Right? I'm just showing off. Okay. And then here is a green neuron. Okay, I don't know how close I got with that. But anyway, I'll stop showing off now. So you can see the red neuron synapses where? What part of the postsynaptic cell? It's the cell body. What's another name for the cell body? That's the soma, right? So this kind of synapse right here is what we call an axosomatic synapse, right? Remember, in anatomy, we can join words together as long as we put an O between them. So axosomatic means that it's a synapse between an axon and the soma of the postsynaptic cell. So how would you classify these synapses right here? These are axodendritic because they synapse on a dendrite, right? And then these right here are pretty special. We're just beginning to learn a little bit about these. We don't know a whole lot about these. These are kind of special synapses, all right? But these are axo, since this, what part of a neuron is this? This is the axon, so these are axoaxonic synapses. So there are different ways that we talk about synapses, but in every case, these synapses are chemical synapses. So what's being released at all of these terminal buttons? Neurotransmitter of some kind, right? Okay. For these cells to communicate. All right, so this is what a synapse looks like. Kind of like a neuromuscular junction, but you can see that the postsynaptic membrane is not so convoluted. Right, but there still nonetheless is a space between the cells that we call the synaptic cleft. When an electrical signal comes down, oh, look what's in this terminal button here. You got a lot of ATP factories for making ATP. You got synaptic vesicles that are holding neurotransmitter to be released. When an electrical impulse comes down and flows over this terminal button, that allows calcium to enter the cell, just like the neuromuscular junction. And that's going to cause the fusion of these vesicles to the presynaptic membrane. And when it fuses, that exocytosis neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. And then the neurotransmitter moves to the postsynaptic membrane where it binds to a receptor protein and causes another electrical signal to develop on the postsynaptic cell. So just like the neuromuscular junction, how is information transmitted? Within a neuron and down an axon, it's what kind of signal? And that's an electrical signal. And then when it moves across the synapse, like right through here, that's what kind of signal? That's a chemical signal because it's a chemical synapse. And then the signal moves down the postsynaptic cell as an electrical signal. So it always goes electrical, chemical, electrical through a chemical synapse. All right, so what else do I want to say about this slide? Nothing, but you should have a model in your mind of what? What a general synapse, how it works and what it looks like. Okay. How is it, can information go both ways across this synapse? Or is it one way? One way. And it can only go, what are the two reasons why you would explain to somebody it can only go one way? You have receptors on one side. What cell has receptors? The postsynaptic cell has receptors, so it can only receive information. All right, and what's the second reason? The synaptic vesicles. There's only one cell that has neurotransmitter. What's the only cell that can send a signal? That's the presynaptic cell, right? So that's the reason, those two reasons explain why information only flows in one direction. But you know, information flows in two directions in your body. right? It can go from your central nervous system to your periphery, or from your periphery to your central nervous system. So if a synapse can only transmit information one way, how is it that you have two-way communication in your body? Why is that? Because you have two different nervous systems. You have, what, an afferent nervous system and an efferent nervous system, different structures. You have different nerves carrying information both ways, right? You have the sensory versus the motor nervous system. Okay, let me go back to this slide right here. So, yeah, so don't forget, sensory is one whole nervous system, which is structurally different than the motor nervous system. And it has to be that way because information can only travel one way through these nervous systems. Okay. Okay, so we're covering this thing right here. Ability to conduct electrical impulses. Ah, neurons do live a long time. Okay, they don't replace themselves. They don't divide. We're maybe beginning to learn in some places of your body or under certain circumstances they can divide, but basically the neurons that we have to last us our whole lifetime, as opposed to our skin cells. Right? They slough off all the time, and then they're rejuvenated. Those layers are rebuilt. What area of the skin rebuilds your skin all the time? What's the layer that rebuilds your skin all the time? That would be the stratum what? The stratum basale, right? That's the living layer. All right, but since neurons are communicating with each other by making neurotransmitter and releasing neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft that requires a lot of energy, so neurons, right, say are very metabolic. It's one of the most metabolic regions in your whole body. That means it requires a lot of ATP. So does anybody have an idea how much ATP, for instance, your brain really needs? Anybody have a feel? Did we talk about this in here yet? Maybe not. Okay. All right. Let me see if I can find that picture of that synapse. Let's go back right here. All right. So here's a mitochondria. What does a mitochondria produce? ATP. Yeah, I think you know that. Now, what you might not know, what does a mitochondria need to make ATP? Okay, it needs a couple things. It needs a fuel source, and a good fuel molecule would be glucose. All right, so it needs sugar in order to make ATP. But it needs something else, too. It can't, even if it has sugar and all the ability to make ATP, it needs another molecule. And it needs, and it's the reason why we inhale all the time, it needs oxygen. All right, so mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP. So if you cut off oxygen supply to mitochondria, guess what it cannot make? ATP. And then all of the processes inside your body that need ATP do what? Well, they stop, right? When they run out of ATP, all those processes stop, including what? Synaptic transmission, right? So neurons can't communicate with each other. So what happens to you if the neurons of your brain stop communicating with each other? What happens to you? Okay, well, you pass out. You lose consciousness, right? In order to maintain consciousness, all those neurons need to be communicating with each other. And what molecule gives your brain the ability to maintain consciousness? It is ATP made by mitochondria. And what do mitochondria need in order for you to maintain consciousness? Oxygen. Yeah. Oh, did I tell you to ask that question right now? No, I didn't, but I'm glad you did, because I want to talk about that right now. That's an excellent question. Okay? So what happens if you cut off oxygen to mitochondria? Can't make ATP? What happens to you? You pass out, you lose consciousness. All right? Now there are certain circumstances when oxygen is cut off to the brain. Like when? Not a very good condition. It's when your heart stops beating. Okay, when you go into fibrillation, for instance, asystole, blood stops going to your brain. Mitochondria don't get oxygen. Mitochondria don't produce ATP. How long does it take for your neurons, all the neurons of your brain, to use up the ATP and you can't maintain consciousness? Is it like 12 hours or a couple days or... Okay, this is how much ATP your brain needs You lose consciousness in 3 seconds. You run out of ATP in 3 seconds. Lose consciousness when your heart stops. All right, so that underscores how important those mitochondria are. All right, but not only consciousness, you need ATP to just stay what? Alive. All right, so how long can your brain go without ATP, without the ability to make ATP before it actually dies? So 3 seconds and you lose consciousness, but after what period of time will your brain actually die as a result of that? Okay, and it's 3 minutes, not a very long period of time. So 3 seconds, you lose consciousness, 3 minutes, and your brain dies. And when your brain dies, what does that mean? Can it ever come back?
No.
No, once something's dead, it can't come back to life again. All right, so... Okay, well, yeah, I just kind of made it just similar like that. That's ballpark. Okay, a number of minutes. Okay. Now, there are techniques you can learn to prolong somebody's life, for instance, when their heart stops. You can actually beat somebody's heart for them when their heart won't beat for themselves. What do you call that? Yeah, that's called CPR, when you do chest compressions on somebody. And you should probably do something else every once in a while, too, and that is you should breathe for them. Right? So you should do mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Huh? Oh, well, okay. So we're almost done with lecture, not quite. So what was I saying? Okay, so who knows CPR in here? Anybody know CPR? Oh, that's excellent. Okay. So you can prolong somebody's life. You can have their brain still make a lot of ATP. If you might not be able to make enough by doing CPR to have them come back to consciousness, but you can make maybe enough ATP to what? Keep their brain alive until they can get to the hospital. Right? So that's real important. All right, so another way to think about how important ATP is by knowing something about how heavy you are. How about how many, in a textbook, what's a textbook weight of a person in terms of kilograms? It's about 70 kilograms for a man, so it would be a little bit less for a woman. I don't know if I know anybody that's 70 kilograms, but that's a textbook figure. How much ATP do you need in your body to keep your body alive? In terms of kilograms, all right? I ask you, not that I think that you should know at this point, but I ask you because I'll tell you now that I have your attention, and that is you need 40 kilograms of ATP to stay alive. What's that compared to your body weight? That's, yeah, even more than half, right? That's more than half of your body weight in ATP just to stay alive. And so that tells you how important this little organelle is right here. It's making, as soon as you use ATP up, what does the mitochondria do? It makes it back again. So you don't need to carry a luggage of ATP around with you with 40 kilograms in it, but you need enough so that the mitochondria can rebuild it. And that's important reason why these mitochondria need oxygen for what? For transmission of electrical impulses across the synapse so that you can maintain consciousness. All right, so next time when we come back, we're going to talk about some of these electrical events. I gotta stop talking. Okay, I guess that's it for lecture.